Hi, everyone. My name is Lily. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is November 8th, 1989. If I were home tonight, I'd be celebrating with my home group. Keep talking. But I planned a family vacation to come down and visit my friends, and my good friend Dick called and said, "Can you come to Atlanta on Thursday?" And I went, "Well, I'm flying to Greenville on Tuesday. Let me see if I can work it out." And, you know, as God would have it, it worked out. And I'm grateful to be here tonight and share my experience with all of you. I had dinner tonight with Salida. Whatever she calls herself, okay? And we were talking about, you know, this fellowship and also Al-Anon. And, you know, the reason that I felt compelled to come here is because Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. Okay, and when I tell you my story, you will believe that Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. And I was sharing a little bit with my cousin before I came here. He didn't think any of this was the least bit funny, but he's very grateful that I'm sober. So let me start. Thank you so much, Dick and Barbara, for thinking of me. And it's great to be here. Boy, is this a beautiful place, huh? Wow. And I got to tell you, home in Maine right now, it's about 31 degrees and freezing rain. So I'm grateful to be here. And I was able to sit out on the terrace this afternoon and soak up the sun. And I felt like, wow, you know. So anyway, it's 8:35. I stand before you fully clothed. That wasn't always the way it was when I... Stop. Polly, now don't look at me like that. So let me tell you a little story about before I started drinking. This happened about 6 months before I started drinking. And I'm down in the South, and so I know all you Southern gals. You know how all how to act and all that when you have those big fancy dresses and, you know, all of that. You know, like Scarlett O'Hara, and you know what I mean? You know what to do with those big ball gowns and all that. Well, I'm a little girl from Maine, and I did not grow up in an alcoholic family. But I really didn't know a lot about all this fancy stuff. But it was my senior graduation, and we had a very strange rule back then that if your date was not a member of the graduating class, they couldn't go to the banquet. And so what happened was his parents, my boyfriend's parents, were going to take us out to dinner. And it was in a really, really fancy restaurant. And I had never eaten in a really fancy, fancy restaurant. I was brought up with four brothers, two grandmothers, my mom and dad. And we didn't go to fancy restaurants. Mom stayed home and cooked. And once in a while, we'd go to the hamburger joint on the corner and get a hamburger and thought it was a big deal. But anyway, this night, my parents had saved up, and they bought me this beautiful dress. Oh, my God, it was so pretty. And it had a big hoop skirt, and I had these white high heels that, you know, they're back in fashion now, those spike shoes. You'll know I'm an old-timer because I don't have them on tonight. And so anyway, they took us to this restaurant called the Portlander. And this was a really fancy place. And they had these menus, and they were like this big, and they had tassels hanging off of them. And his dad said, "You can have anything you want." And I opened the menu, and I ordered the first thing that I saw, so I ordered a fillet mignon. And the waitress wanted to know how I would like it, and I said, "Cooked." I didn't know that there were ways to prepare steak, you know, I mean, so I said, "Cooked." Anyway, they brought this meal, and they set it down in front of us, and I got to tell you, I really wasn't too impressed. But anyway, so there was this fillet on the table and on the plate and a baked potato, and I went to cut the steak, and when I did, it slid off the plate, and it went on the floor. Oh, and first of all, when I sat down in the chair when I got there, I sat down on the hoop. Oof, up it goes, you know. So anyway... So the steak falls on the floor, so I kick it under the table because I don't know what the heck to do with that. And So his dad looks over, and I go, gee, I was really hungry. And, you know, like, I think I swallowed this steak whole, right? And, but anyway, after the meal was over and we got up to leave, I realized I had skewered that steak with the heel of my shoe. So when I walked out, I kind of had to walk out like Groucho Marx so that, you know, they wouldn't notice this hunk of meat hanging off my shoe. And 6 months later, I added alcohol. So you can imagine. And the occasion was my wedding reception. And again, I had a big dress with a big hoop. But by now, my mother had given me lessons on how to sit with its hoop so that I wouldn't give the priest a surprise at church when I sat on it. So, but I didn't really know much about drinking, you know. I wasn't raised in an alcoholic home. On a hot summer's day, my dad might come home with a couple of quarts of beer, and he would split that with my mother and my two grandmothers. And after I started drinking, I thought to myself, why would you even bother bringing two quarts of beer in the house to split with people? I mean, I didn't get it. And but anyway, the occasion was my wedding reception, and the place was the VFW, and I don't know if they have service clubs down here, but at home, if they have a service club, the way that they pour booze is, you know, they ask you what you want, and my dad asked me what I wanted, and I really didn't know. So I said, well, what are you going to have? And he was going to have a whiskey and ginger. So I thought, well, I'll have a whiskey and ginger, too. So in those service clubs, they pour, like, a lot of whiskey and a little bit of ginger. And he said, here's to you. And what I knew about drinking, I'd seen on TV. I'll really date myself now, because what I'd seen on TV was Lucy and Desi going to a cocktail party. For those of you that don't know who Lucy and Desi are, you can check them out on TV Land. But anyway, so if somebody said, here's to you, you downed it. And I did. And the next thing I remember is taking my wedding gown off on the front lawn. And that's the way it was going to be for me when I drank. After that, whenever I drank, I would lose articles of clothing, and they might be momentarily, it might be all night, I don't know, you know, and I don't know what happens to alcoholic women, but a lot of us feel like it's necessary to show you parts of our body that are better left kept secret, you know, but, you know, under the influence of alcohol, sky's the limit, you know. So, the man that I married was an alcoholic. I didn't know he was an alcoholic. How I figured out that he had a drinking problem, I had said to him before we got married, listen, my dad comes home every single night at 4 o'clock. And that's the way it was when I grew up. My dad would come in the house at 4. My mother would have just combed her hair and put on fresh lipstick, and she would be standing at the sink doing the pre-dinner dishes. And he would walk in the door and say, hi, honey, how was your day? So that's what I expected when I got married. You will come in here every day at 4 o'clock and say, hi, honey, how was your day? And so he said he could do that. So, and he did. But what I didn't know is he would bring a case of beer every day when he came home to say, hi, honey, how was your day? And how I figured out he had a drinking problem is he got up one time to go to the bathroom. There was a perfect outline of his body. Because he would sit on the floor. We had furniture, but he liked sitting on the floor. And there was an outline of his body in beer cans, and I thought, I wonder if he's got a drinking problem. You know? Anyway, the marriage was doomed, and we lost our second child to SIDS. And what happened was when that child died, they went to get him at work, and he wasn't at work. He was in a bar. And he never was able to forgive himself. He never, ever got over that, you know. And anyway, we went on to have two more children. And his drinking, he became a violent drunk. And he came home, and we'd get in a fight. And I'm not a girl that's going to sit back and take a bust on the chin without giving something back. And it's just the way, I mean, I was brought up with four brothers, you know. You ain't getting me. And so it was just terrible. You know, the last night we spent together, we almost killed each other. And I'm not proud of that today, but by the time the cops got there, I was on the roof with a vacuum cleaner. I had dragged him from... he kicked me. I was pregnant. He kicked me. I threw boiling water at him. He went into shock. I dragged him the length of the apartment, pushed him out a second-story window. And when the cops got there, I was on the roof with a vacuum cleaner I was going to drop on his head. Because my thinking was if I killed him, it would be self-defense and I could get Social Security. And I wasn't an alcoholic drinker yet, but that just gives you a clue. You know, when I add alcohol, whew. So, anyway, it became clear after our divorce that he wasn't going to be able to support us because he was a real alcoholic. And he couldn't hold down a job anymore, you know, and he drank. And that's what he could do. He could drink. And so it dawned on me that I would need to get to college and get an education because somebody was going to have to take care of these, by now, three children that were left. And so I like to refer to it as the alcoholic woman that if you're an alcoholic woman and you're put in a situation where you become a single parent, you get the big S on your chest. You know, we're super mom and we're super doc and we're super nurse and we're super teacher and we're super everything in our own minds. And we can fix anything. And if you get into trouble, we'll just put on our cape and fly off to save the day. And that's the kind of mom I became for a long time. I mean, I patched up and did what I could do. But the real downfall came after I bought a house. And now, you know, I'm single, so I can go out drinking with my pals. And but I'd go drinking with my pals, I'd lose parts of my clothes, I'd forget to come home. You know, I'd tell the babysitter I was coming home at 1 o'clock, but I wasn't specific. Like, if I met one in the afternoon or one in the morning or one the next day. And so I knew that that wasn't right, that I had to do something about that. So I got this plan, and my plan was that I would get a 12-pack of beer, and I would strategically place it around the backyard, and then I would mow the grass, and when I got to a beer, I'd stop and have one. And so what happened was I mowed that whole yard. I drank all 12 of those beers. I was where I was supposed to be. My yard looked great. I mowed the lawn every day after that. You know, and at the same time, I had a job working for the federal government. It was a really good job. Too bad I hadn't stayed there, but I got a bright idea one day, and that's the story of my drinking. You know, I'd get a good idea, and my good ideas were great, at least in my mind. And so anyway, I went in, and I told the boss that I wanted to raise, and he said he couldn't give me one, and I said I quit. I said, because I've always wanted to be a cowgirl anyway. And he's just looking at me like, you know, I'm a divorced mother with three kids. I have my own house, but I'm going to quit a perfectly good job because I want to be a cowgirl. So I quit, and I got a job that very night. I got a job in a place called the Silver Spur Saloon. And guess what? I'm a cowgirl, right? So you got to wear a costume for this place. And it was a denim skirt and white cowboy boots and a white cowboy hat and a plaid shirt and a denim vest, right? And I weighed about 112 pounds, and I just thought, this is the best job anybody in the world can have. If you're a drunk like I'm a drunk, this is how that goes. You know, you quit a good job to get a job in a saloon or a bar because you got to get closer to the booze, and you can't afford to pay for the amount of booze that you need to maintain yourself, so you get a job in a bar. Because then you can steal it. And so that's what I did, you know. And somewhere along the line, I lost the seat to the front seat of my car. I don't really know, even to this day, what happened to it. I have a very vague memory that it was taken out to put around a campfire somewhere. And I think a keg of beer and some tequila was involved, but I know the tequila was there. I'm not sure about the seat. But I know one thing. It wasn't in my car. And so the fellas that I was drinking with said, well, you can't drive a car with no seat. So we bolted a milk crate to the front seat, where the front seat goes. And then we had a 2x4, and we had a piece of wood. And we jammed the 2x4 between the back seat and that piece of wood to make a back for the seat. And then we put a pillow on it, and my seatbelt was a bungee cord. And I drove my car around that way. And one night I got pulled over by the cops. And this was in February, and it was really cold in Maine. And I intuitively knew how to handle situations which used to baffle us before I knew I was baffled, you know. And so the blue lights come on, and the cop is knocking on the window. And I'm thinking, Lily, do not open the car door. Because if you do, and he sees you sitting on a milk crate, it's probably going to make him upset, and he'll arrest you. It never occurred to me that he might arrest me because I was drunk. I just thought that sitting on a milk crate had to be against the law. I mean, so he knocked on the window, and I rolled down the window, and he said, "What are you doing? Where have you been?" And I said, "Well, you want me to tell the truth?" And he was, you know, I mean, a little exasperated. He was like, "Well, we like the truth." And I said, "Okay, then." And I start crying, and I go, "My horse died. And I have just come from burying him." Listen, you can't bury anything in Maine in February. Well, today you can with a backhoe, but back then, you know, you couldn't be a horse. See, the thing of it is, I know you guys are alcoholic because you're laughing. Because you see, the deal is, we tell these preposterous stories. When the truth would suffice, we make up some crazy story. And the real deal is, if you're a real alcoholic, you actually think that they believe you. You know, because while you're telling the story, you believe it. I mean, I was so sad. I mean, I was sad for a whole week because my horse died. I don't have a horse. I never had a horse, but I was sad the whole week. People say to me, "What's the matter with you?" I go, "My horse died." They go, "What horse? You don't have a horse." So sad. Had to bury him out behind the saloon, you know. Yeah. So anyway, I love this job. I loved this job. I mean, they played country music. They used to get these big country stars came in, and it was just the coolest job that anybody could have. And the problem was I didn't know enough to go home when I got off duty. I stayed there and I drank and I drank and I drank. And I got in trouble. And so anyway, one night, it was really hot now. It's July and it's really hot, and I got another good idea. I said to some friends of mine, "Why don't we go skinny dipping? After we get off to work tonight, we'll go skinny dipping." And they thought it was a good idea. And so we drove up to this place, and it was a bridge, and we're going to jump off this bridge. I wouldn't jump off a bridge for $1 million any day of the week. But because it was my idea, I had to do it because, you know, you look like a fool if you're not going to carry on with your own idea. So we took our clothes off, we folded them all up, and instead of putting them in the vehicle, we put them outside on the edge of the bridge, all folded up nice and neat. And by this time, I was one of these people that I would park my vehicle on the side of the road, and when I did, I would get out, put the keys on the front passenger tire, on the top of the tire, and get back in the vehicle. Because I know enough to not have the keys in the vehicle, because if you do, they'll get you for drunk driving. So we take our clothes off. We put them by the side of the road. We all jump off the bridge. It's 2:00 in the morning. We're being really quiet, like six drunks can be. Somebody called the cops, and the blue lights come, and I say to my friends, "I got a great idea. Let's swim downstream." So we swim downstream, and we're in the river. And by now we're getting cold. Even in July in Maine, the rivers are cold, you know. So we're in there. We're like, "Oh, hurry up. They better leave. We're going to freeze to death down here." Anyway, the cops leave. And so we get out of the river, and we're going up through somebody's backyard. Six people naked running through their backyard, 2:30 in the morning, freezing. And we're being really quiet. "Hey, did you see that? Oh my God, that guy over there!" You know, and we're hollering and ranting and raving like lunatics. And we get up to the vehicle, and the cops had taken our clothes. And so, one of the guys that was with us, he was married, and he said to me, "Lily, my wife is going to be really pissed if I go home and my hair's all wet." And I said, "True story." I said, "All right then, Gil, I'll tell you what. You get in front and you stick your head out the window and I'll drive really fast and you can blow dry your hair." And he's like, "Good idea, you know." So we all pile in the car. We're all naked. We pile in the car. He's got his head out the window. I'm going really fast. The blue lights come on and I say, "Let me handle it." So cop comes up, shines his flashlight in the car. There's six naked people. And he says, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Jesus, it's hot." We're just riding around trying to get cooled off. He said, "Why don't you get there? Where do you live?" I said, "Just down the road." He said, "Why don't you get there?" So we got there, you know. And it's funny because about 5 years ago now, I'm in the mall at home. And it's Christmas time, and I see Gil, that he's walking down the mall with his wife, and he sees me, and he goes, you know, like I'm going to tell now. Oh, my God. So, that's what my drinking was like. It never got better. It got worse, you know. By now, the saloon has closed, and I've had to get a real job. And my youngest son got kicked out of school because they suspected he was selling marijuana in school. And so I was working in the AmVets. And I would drink every day, and I would have the happy hour crowd. And what happened is one day, the school called and said that they suspected my son was the drug dealer in the school. And he was about this tall. You know, and I'm thinking, if he's the drug dealer, man, oh man, you guys got problems. But anyway, I was already drunk. So what I did was I ate about 10 eucalyptus cough drops on the way to the school, thinking that would cover up the smell of alcohol. And when I got there, he was sitting there, and he's going, "I don't give a care." I said, "You wait till I get you home. I'll kill you." And anyway, but the alcoholic mother decides that she should take the marijuana sample down to the chief of police to get it analyzed. And in the meantime, we have to appear before the school board. So I dress up like Copper Valley PTA. Off we go to the school board. I say to this kid what every normal mother says to their child: "Follow my example. I will show you how to deal with these nitwits." Okay? So, and this is on TV, but bear in mind, this board meeting is on TV. So I get there, and he's sitting in the chair, and this guy says to me, "We suspect that your son is the drug dealer and that he's selling marijuana at school." And I said, "Well, you can suspect all you want," I said, "but I have a report here from the chief of police, and what he was selling was oregano. And I don't know anything about pot. It's not my story." And then this other guy on the school board looks at me and he goes, "You know, my son wouldn't do that." And I looked at him and I said, "And why wouldn't your son do that?" And he said, "Well, because he's a Boy Scout." And I looked at him and I said, "You're an idiot. This is on TV. You're an idiot." I said, "Because my son's in the same troop with yours, and I think he got the oregano from your son." So the end result was they kicked my son out of school. They expelled him. And so they referred him to an alternative school. And I took him to this alternative school. And when I left, one of the other kids, my son was like this tall. And all the other kids his age in high school were, you know, 5'10", 6 feet tall. This kid's like maybe 5 feet. When I left that day in the alternative school, one of the other kids had him by the arm. He's swinging him around going, "You're going to love this school. No rules. It's great." And I'm thinking, a school with no rules. I wonder if I could get a job there. you know. So I went there the next day and I volunteered. I volunteered for a whole year. And then they hired me. And I stayed there for 34 years. But I'm going to tell you that at the time that I was, at the last 3 years that I drank, I knew that I was an alcoholic. You know, I knew that I was an alcoholic because I make that promise that every alcoholic makes. Tomorrow, I won't drink. You know, and you don't make that promise out loud to anybody. You just say that sort of to yourself because what if you can't do it? You know, so you make the promise to yourself, tomorrow I won't drink, you know, and then tomorrow would come and I couldn't fulfill that promise to myself. So then I'd make the next promise that an alcoholic makes. Tomorrow I won't drink until 4 o'clock. And then you can't do that. So you just, and then finally you just go the heck with it. I guess I'm just going to keep drinking. So on the night before my last drunk, I got a job in the school as a school bus driver. And on the night before my last drunk, I dyed my hair purple. And I mean, when I say purple, it was purple. Like the color of her shirt, purple. And it was long before it was fashionable for people to be wandering around with colored hair. And women my age certainly didn't wander around with purple hair. My hair was so purple that when I went out in the sun, it would stop traffic. Anyway, I went to the bar and I told the bartender that I thought I might be an alcoholic. I wasn't sure, and he should keep the drinks coming while I made up my mind. You know, and then I also remember that sometime during the course of that evening, I said to him, I'm going to ask God to give me a sign. If God gives me a sign, I'll quit drinking. The next morning, I got up, and I picked up 15 kids on this bus, and driving across, it was a country road. It was an alternative school. The school was 20 miles away from where I was picking the kids up. I had a full load of kids on the bus, and I broke out in a sweat, and I was like, what the heck is wrong with me? You know, and then I got this pressure in my chest, and I felt like I had an elephant sitting on my chest, and I could barely breathe. And all of a sudden, it dawned on me, you know, oh, my God, I'm having a heart attack. And all I could think of was, please, God, don't let me go off the road while I'm driving these kids to school. You know, I made it to school, and as soon as I got off the bus, I collapsed. And the next thing I remember is waking up in the ambulance thinking it didn't need to be that big a sign. You know, like, whoa. You know, they put me in the hospital, and I had tubes and monitors everywhere that there can be tubes and monitors, and they had called my family in. And unbeknownst to me, they had said to my family members they weren't sure if I was going to make it or not. And I'll never forget, because my brothers are not alcoholics. And they always say to me, how come you're the alcoholic? And today my answer is, I'm the lucky one. You know? But my brother came. My brother was there with my mom. And he came up to the stretcher that I'm on. And it dawned on me that the pillowcase was white. I had purple hair. And I'm thinking, you better come up with a good one. And he said very innocently to me, gee, sis, what happened? And I said, I don't know, but whatever they're giving me, it's turning my hair purple. And I'm a real alcoholic because I believed it. I knew that I did it. But on the other hand, when it pinch came to shove, oh, no, I didn't. Whatever they're giving me is turning my hair purple. So I went in the hospital on October the 28th, 1989. I got out of the hospital on November 8th, 1989. And this is why I consider November 8th to be my sobriety date. I couldn't even allow my family members to take me home because that beautiful home that I started with, the one where I mowed the grass every day and, you know, raked the leaves and cut the, you know, I didn't use a weed whacker. I used scissors because it was easier to hide beer and, you know, I had destroyed this house, literally destroyed this house. You know, the living room was pumpkin orange because one Christmas Eve, after I put up the tree and put the presents under the tree that had no carpet on the floor, and I'm thinking, what's wrong with it? And I decided that I needed to paint it. And so I didn't have enough of any one color, so I went downstairs and I mixed up all the paint I had. And it came out this odd, god-awful pumpkin orange, and I painted everything in the living room, including the branches of the Christmas tree. And there were punch holes in the walls. None of the doors locked. And what I didn't know until a few years after I got sober, in actuality, is that There were 13 windows in that house, and 13 windows in that house had bullet holes in them. I don't know if I was shooting out, the neighbors were shooting in. I still don't know. I mean, my brother moved in with me, and he took one look at it, and he goes, "What the hell is going on?" And I'm like, "I don't know. Are those in-going or out-going or incoming?" And he was like, "It's not funny." And I'm like, "Well, I didn't say it was funny. I just want to know if I was shooting out or they were shooting in." I mean, and he's like, "You have no idea how they got there." I said, "I have no idea at all. None." So I couldn't let my family members take me home. So I had a friend take me home and drop me off at the end of the driveway. And when I got up to the house, it was November 8th, it was cold. There was a note on the door from the bank, and they were foreclosing on my house. And when I went inside the house, there was no lights, no heat, no running water, no groceries, no telephone, no kids. And I thought to myself, I'm not staying here. So I went to the bar, where I always drank. You know, I walked into that bar, I sat down in the same seat I always sat in. Every single time. There was a mirror behind that bar. I don't know that I ever saw that mirror behind that bar before, but I might have and said, "Here's to you, kid." But that night, I doctored my hand all up to do a shot of tequila. And I looked up and I saw myself in the mirror. And what I saw scared me. And it was that quick. Like this whole vision went in front of my eyes, you know. You're hopeless and you're helpless and you're pathetic. And you're drunk and you're a mother. And your kids deserve way more than I'm getting. And I set that drink down. I paid for it, but I set it down on the bar and I walked out of there. And that's why I consider November 8th to be my sobriety date. Because I was in the bar. I would have drank except for that moment of clarity. By the next morning, the moment of clarity had sort of worn off. And I'm thinking, well, but I had a doctor's appointment. And I went to the doctor's appointment. The doctor said to me, "Lily, you had a heart attack as a direct result of your abuse of alcohol." And he said, "I want to tell you that while we were doing the test on your heart, we discovered that you have third stage cirrhosis of the liver. And if you don't quit drinking, you'll be dead in 5 years. And if you can't quit on your own, you probably ought to go to AA. Well, a normal person would have been happy for that information, but I wasn't. I was like, what the heck is AA, you know? I went to work that afternoon because I didn't know enough to stay home. And there was a lady at my work, as a matter of fact, she was my boss. And she said, "Lily, you can't stay here today, but I wrote you a letter and I want you to go home and read it." And I went home and I opened this letter, and in the letter it said, "We love you very much." She said, "It broke our hearts to see you leaving in an ambulance. The kids that you work with absolutely adore you. The staff love you. And I think you have a problem with alcohol. And the reason that I think that is because I'm a member in good standing of AA. And I'd like to tell you, as I stand here tonight, I thought, well, isn't that enlightening? That is the most wonderful thing. I thought, what a B-I-T-C-H, ought to mind her own business. Leave me the heck alone. But at the bottom of the letter, she said, it would be my honor to take you to a meeting of AA. And I had just enough people pleasing left in me that I said to her, the next day when I went back to work, I said to her, "Okay, I'll go to a meeting with you." She said, "Great, come to my house tonight and we'll have dinner." And I said, "Okay." So, you know, that night that I got in the van, besides asking God to give me give me a sign that I was an alcoholic, this is what my prayer sounded like. "Please, God, let me have one tenth of the faith that my mother has." And so anyway, that afternoon came and it was, you know, time to go to our house. And I knew I wasn't going, because that's the kind of gal I am. You know, I'm the one that's sitting on the bar stool and you say to me, "I'm going to move tomorrow." And I'll say, "Oh, well, I'll come help you, you know. But when tomorrow comes, you better come get me, because I'll be at the bar drinking, and to heck with you, I'm, you know." So anyway, it's coming closer to the time to leave to go to her house. And I knew that I wasn't going to go. I'm not going to no meeting of AA, no, thank you very much. But what I heard was my mother's voice in my head. My mother wasn't there, but I heard this voice, and it said, "You know, if you're not going to go, you ought to call her and tell her you're not coming. It'd be really rude not to show up." And I went to my phone and picked it up, but the phone was dead. And it never occurred to me to go to a phone booth. And for those of you that are young and don't know what I'm talking about, they were like these little small shacks on the side of the road that had phones in them, and you went in and put a quarter in. You call somebody, and the person on the other end would actually answer the phone and say hello. Yeah, well, but I never thought of going there. So I drove 15 miles to her house to tell her that I couldn't come. And she said, come right in. And I never will forget how I felt, you know, because I walked in, she had the table all set, and at my place, she had a gift wrapped up, and it had a bow on it. And when I unwrapped it, it was a big blue book. And on the front cover in white letters, it said Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember the sweat on my lip, and I'm thinking, how in the hell am I going to get out of this? You know, now there's a book. Oh, God. You know, so she said to me, why don't you read what's inside the front cover? And inside the front cover, she had written, to Lily, my friend with love, may you someday know how important this day is to me. Fasten your seatbelt and welcome to the greatest adventure of your life, one day at a time. And then we went to this meeting, and we went outside, and there was this old guy standing outside the door, and you had to walk down 6 steps to go into this church basement. And he was shaking like a leaf. And he stuck his hand out to me, and he said, welcome, you're amongst your own kind. And I looked at him, and I thought, I don't think so, bucko. No. The next guy that I met was as tall as the old man was short. I thought the old man had the DTs and somebody ought to get him a drink. And turned out he had 50 years. But then the next guy I met was as tall as this guy was short. And his waist came right about to my eye level. And he had this belt buckle that said, bullshit. And he said to me, why don't you keep coming back, honey? It gets better and better every day. And I thought, you people are out of your minds. Sat in the third row. I'm very judgmental. I have taken all of your inventory. And you are all losers. And I am not joining this outfit. The hell with you. I can do this on my own. And then I went to the front of the room. Because people were laughing like you're laughing. And they were greeting each other. And they were hugging each other. And I saw a coffee pot at the front of the room. And I went to the coffee pot. I literally took the cover off and sniffed it. Like, there's got to be something in it. They can't be this happy and they get not drinking. Then they went around the room and they introduced themselves, each person. And I'm in the third row in the end seat. And they still got that little bit of people pleasing, you know. So I've taken your inventory. You're all a bunch of losers. I'm not joining this outfit. And you got around. By the time it got to me, I said, I'm Lily. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, my God. I'm an alcoholic. And they're all laughing. You know, they thought it was great fun. And this lady gave a talk. I don't have a clue what she said. But what I remember her saying was, here at the Portland Group, we have a way to help you start a new way of life by offering you a white chip. And she held up a poker chip. And I thought, seriously? You got to be kidding. You don't drink and they pay you in poker chips? That's going to keep me sober, yeah. A white chip, yeah, great. But the next words she said were the words that saved my life. Because, you see, when I was a little girl, I had 4 brothers, and when I was a little girl, they used to tease me unmercifully. And I would cry, and I'd carry on. And my Grammy would always say to me, Lily, don't let them see that you're afraid, and they'll stop bugging you. Because if they don't get a reaction, they're just going to stop. So that became my mantra for the rest of my life, and I never knew it until I got to AA. So no matter how afraid I ever was, I would get in your face. I don't need you. I don't need you. I'll do this all by myself. She said, if you're too afraid to pick up a white chip, see me after the meeting and I'll give you one. Well, I've already taken your inventory. You're all a bunch of losers. I ain't joining this outfit, but I am not afraid of you, so I'm going to march up there and get that chip. And I did, and the whole room started applauding. And I'm thinking, whoa, they haven't been applauding many places I've been lately. So, anyway, and then there was this lady at the end of the meeting, this beautiful lady. I've never, ever seen her again. Her name was Pearl. She got up, and she said to me at the end of the meeting, keep coming back. I have a disease of perception. I thought she said, we need you. And I knew you guys did, because I looked around and I was like, these guys have no organization. They have no clue what the hell's going on. I'm going to stick around until I'm the exalted ruler of AA and get them all set on the right path, and then I'll leave and I'll go back to drinking. But you guys have a remarkable way of saying to people, you know, did you get a sponsor? Did you get a sponsor? If you knew, you know, did you get a sponsor? So finally you get a sponsor, you know, because you're like, geez, I'll do anything to get them to just shut up about it, you know. So did you get a sponsor? Well, they had the 12 steps and the 12 traditions hanging on the wall, and I'm no dummy. I mean, I read those at the first meeting, and I thought, I'll get a sponsor that I drank with, and then I won't have to do those steps because they know what I did, you know. That was a big mistake. So I picked this lady that I drank with, and she immediately set me on a course of reading the big book from cover to cover and working the program. And this is my thought, just so that you'll know how sick I was when I got here. She would tell me things to do, and I would think to myself, I wonder if they have a special school for sponsors to go to, where they teach them idiot crap to say when you tell them that you've got a problem. You know, they'll give you some idiot solution. Because my problem was they were going to foreclose on my house, and her solution was, why don't I call the bank manager and tell him I'm an alcoholic? And I'm driving home, and I'm thinking, yeah, that's really a bright idea. But now I've convinced myself that there's a special school for sponsors, and you go to school and you learn stupid stuff to tell people, and then all the rest of you that are sitting in these rooms are spies. And so if you don't do what that sponsor told you to do, one of you is probably the bank manager, and you're going to know that I didn't do what she said, and you're going to rat me out. Sorry. That's the way I was thinking. Anyway, I did that. I went to the bank. I said to the bank manager, hi, I'm Lily. I'm an alcoholic. He said, we know. Whew. Well, it takes a load off my shoulders. So I said, well, I owe you a lot of money, and I want to know what you want to do about it. And he said, well, we don't want your house. And I'm thinking to myself, well, I don't want it either. I mean, my best solution was bulldoze it over and start new, you know. The alcoholic thinker, you know. You ruined it, so just bulldoze it over and start over. And he said, well, do you think you could pay me $80 a month until you pay the back debt? Yeah, that seemed reasonable to me. Yeah, I guess I can. So then I go home and I call my sponsor, because those were the instructions. After you meet with the bank manager, call me up. So I call her up, and she goes, how'd it go? And I said, well, they don't want my house. She said, I didn't think they did. And she said, what did you say? And I said, well, I made a deal. I'd pay him $80 a month. I said, what am I supposed to do now? She said, pay him. Wow. Pay him? Actually give him $80 a month? You know, and I did that. And I can't tell you how good I felt that very first month, $80 in cash, and I would only give it to him every month until I paid that debt back. And it got so it was a joke at the bank. They'd go, oh, it's the last day of the month. Lily will be here, and she's only going to speak to John, the manager, and she's going to give him money. So John could never take the last day of the month off because I wouldn't give it to anybody else. You know, and then she told me I had to clean my house using the 3-foot method. I was like, here we go again. I never heard of that. She says, well, I'm going to tell you how to do it. She said, open the front door and clean the first 3 feet. Clean everything in that 3 feet. Clean the floor, clean the walls, clean the ceiling. Figure out what you're keeping and what you're getting rid of. What you're keeping, find a place to put it where it'll always be. And she said, and when you find out, you find something that you want to get rid of, put it in the car and take it to the dump. When you get done, get a chair, put it in that 3-foot section and call me. I was like, you got to be kidding. I wonder which program she went through to learn that, you know, solution. But you see, she knew that I was a real alcoholic. Because you see, if you're anything like I am, if you're drunk like I am, we create horrendous messes in our lives and all of the lives of those people around us. Then we get sober, and we're sober for 20 minutes, and we think we can fix it all just like that. I don't know why they don't trust me, you know. And she said, if you went in that house and you couldn't fix it all in one day, you'd say the hell with it and drink. So you do 3 foot at a time. So I call her up after I get the 3 feet done, and I go, what now? And she goes, tomorrow you can do the next 3 feet. I completely restored that house. I completely paid the bank back. You know, $80 a month extra until it was paid off. I cleaned that house up. I actually went to the bank and got a loan to replace all those windows that had bullet holes in them. You know, I didn't know how to do any of that. I didn't know how to do any of that. You know, and I started working the program, and she said to me, Lily, she says, your kids are pretty well grown up. She said, why don't you volunteer at the CSO office and answer the phones? And one day while I was answering the phone, my daughter called, and she needed help. I don't recommend you 12-step your own kids, but that's just how it worked for me that day. You know, I got off the phone, and I said to the director of CSO, I have no idea what to do. And he says, yeah, you do. He says, you go get another woman. And you go and tell her that, you know, if she does what you do, she'll never have to feel like this again. You know, and today she's sober 27 years. And she doesn't do this kind, you know. She says to me, Mom, I can't believe you go all over the place speaking. She says, because I wouldn't. I says, I can't believe it either, because I was a girl that wouldn't give a book report when I was in school. Anyway, so now I have 3 children. Two of them are alcoholic, and one of them is the hero of the family. Everything he ever wanted to do, he accomplished. Everything. You know, Mom, I want to be a Little League all-star team. Mom, I want to play hockey. Mom, I want to do this. Mom, I want to do that. Mom, I want to be a Marine. Mom, I want to be this. I want to be that. Everything he ever wanted to do, he did, and he did to excess. He joined the Marine Corps. He was the Marine of the cycle. You know, I got to go down there and see him graduate. I couldn't figure out why he wouldn't look at me. And he's leading this whole group of men down the field, and I'm saying, well, why won't he look at me? And he's going, well, he's got a job to do, you know. And it ain't wave to mama. And so after I got sober, and after he left the Marine Corps, he worked for the Department of Defense in Washington, D.C., and his job was to guard foreign dignitaries. And he would call me up, and he'd say, Mom, I can't tell you who I'm guarding, but watch the news, and you'll figure it out. You know, and so he guarded Pope John, and he has his cell phone, and he says, calls me up. He goes, Mom, listen to this. And you could hear all these kids, the Catholic Youth Organization, when the Pope came to Washington, D.C., and the kids in the background were chanting, we love you, John Paul. We love you, John Paul. Then he called me another day, and he goes, Mom, you're never going to believe who I guarded today. And I said, no, I don't know. And he goes, Mother Teresa. And he said, the greatest thrill of my life, he says, is when we got done today, she asked all of us policemen to come in. Well, by then he had left the, and he was with the police department. He went in and she hugged him and thanked him for his service. So anyway, to backtrack a little bit, he called me up and he said, Mom, I want to be a policeman. And I was like, I know you've always wanted to be a policeman. Since he was 5 years old, he wanted to be a policeman. So he went to the police academy, graduated with honors, became a policeman for Metropolitan Police Department in Washington, D.C. And by now I'm sober, and I was being asked to go around some different places and speak. And so I got an opportunity to speak in New Jersey, Cape May, New Jersey, in 2002. And I called him up and I said, Sammy, I'm going to be speaking at this convention in Cape May, New Jersey. He said, hey, can anybody go to that? And I said, yeah. And he says, great. He says, I can take the ferry from Delaware. I'll come over and join you for the weekend. And he came that weekend, and he met all my friends in AA, and we had a great time, and I made my amends to him, and we raced each other to the top of the Cape May Lighthouse, and then I had him picking up these white rocks on the beach. And he's like, why am I picking up these white rocks? And I said, because your mother leads women's retreats now. Your crazy mother leads women's retreats, and I don't know what I'm going to do with these white rocks, but I know I'm going to need them. So he helped me pick up rocks, and we gathered up all these rocks. And that night I gave my talk, and after it was over, he came up to me, and he said, Mom, I don't know where you got that. And I said, well, it's a gift from God. And I said, and you have a gift from God because you're working with the real unfortunate people in Washington, D.C. He wasn't around the monuments. He was in the 7th District in Washington, D.C. Anyway, we had a marvelous weekend. He met all my friends in AA, and he was like, oh, my God, these people love you, and you love them, and it's wonderful, and you don't drink. And, man, it's great, you know. It's so good to see you so alive, you know. And 6 weeks to the day that I hung out with him, I got the phone call that no mother wants to get. At 2:10 in the morning, I was called to be told that my son had passed away. And the first thing that I did after I got that news was I got on my knees and I prayed to the Blessed Mother. And I believe that was another gift from God. I get on my knees and I pray to the Blessed Mother because I knew that she knew what it was like to lose a son. And she had, in fact, watched them murder hers. And all I said was, please help me get through this. And at 5:00 in the morning, I call one person in AA. And I could barely get the words out of my throat, you know, that my son was gone. And the next thing I remember is everybody in AA was at my house. They surrounded me with love. Because I had been involved in service at the state level. Everybody knew me. And they all came. And they held my hand, you know. And they showed me how to put one foot in front of the other. You know, my son had a hero's funeral. The policeman from Washington, D.C. came. You know, they brought his cruiser. It was all decked out in black. And 70 policemen came. And I talked to the chief of police in Washington. I said, who's guarding the shop down there? We're at the funeral home, and they had an honor guard for him, and the place was packed. It was just packed with people. And my son's police partner came up to me, and he said, Lily, I've never seen anything like this in my life. He said, I've been to a lot of funerals for a lot of cops, but I have never seen anybody with this many friends. And I said, yeah, I know, they couldn't all come. He said, what? I said, well, they wanted to, but when they got here and saw all these cruises, they kept on going. You know, the fellows I was drinking with had warrants. And you know, now my third child is out there tonight, homeless and helpless. Pathetic, drunk, drug addict. I danced a dance with that kid from the time he's 13. He just turned 49. He's been in and out of prison several times. He's been sober and not sober, and now he's not sober again. And, you know, I was lucky enough to find my way into the halls of Al-Anon as well. And today the greatest gift I can give him is to let him go. And I couldn't do that for a long, long time. I couldn't. He was my son. You didn't understand. And I've buried two children. This kid is dying. I have to do something to help him. And the bottom line is, the only thing I can do to help him is let him go. And so we recently had a conversation in October. He called me one more time, and he needed one more time. He needed something else from Mama. You know, I need rent money. I need, you know, can you help me pay for rehab? You know, can you do this? Can you do that? And I very sweetly and sincerely said to him, no, I can't. I have two things that I can offer you. I can offer you prayers, and I can offer you my undying love. And that's all I have. I have nothing else left to give you. And as hard as it has been to let him go and know that he's on the street, I feel freer than I've ever felt. Because everything that I tried to do for him didn't do a darn thing for him, you know. And I had to come here and learn that from you guys. I will tell you a funny little story about my homeless son. Last February, it was really cold out. It's very cold in Maine in February, about 20 below that night. And he called, wanted to know if I could take him to a meeting. Now, I'll take you to a meeting. So I took him to the meeting. And after the meeting, I said to him, how about if I take you out and get you something to eat? Because I thought, you know, I will buy him a meal. I won't give him money, but I'll buy him a meal, right? And he said to me, no, thanks. I think I'll go home and tidy up my place. And I'm like, tidy up your place? You're homeless. How do you tidy up your place? What do you, rearrange trash bags? What do you do when you're homeless? You're sleeping under a trailer on wood pallets. You know, it's not like you can move a lamp in or something, you know. And he's like, you don't get it. I said, well, obviously not. 2 days later, he called me to tell me he's being evicted. I said, how can you be evicted? You're homeless. And he's like, well, they're moving the trailer, so I got to get out of here. You know, so even though it's terrible, I see the humor in it. You know, you've got to be kidding me. But that's what alcoholism does to us. That's what drug addiction, you know. I'm lucky enough that I never did drugs. It wasn't my thing. I tried smoking pot once. I was so high I could have gone duck hunting with a rake. And I said, this isn't for me. You know, it's just not for me. I just wanted to go to sleep, you know, and I missed the party. And so I didn't do that again. I was like, yeah, forget that. So my name is Lily, and I'm an alcoholic. And I lost my little thing I was going to... Oh, no, I didn't. Here it is. So I'll tell you one more story before I end, and I want to tell you this story about traveling. And everybody thinks, you know, it's just this marvelous thing. You get to travel all over the country. But in reality, generally speaking, you spend all day Friday in an airport getting to the place where you're going and all day Sunday getting home. But when you get there, it's fabulous fun, no question. But I've had a few things that have happened to me on the road, and I'll just share one story with you. A few years ago, I was in Texas in February, and in Maine, in the Northeast, they were having a blizzard. And so we go to the airport, and I asked the gal, can I change my plane to tomorrow because there's a blizzard in Maine? And she's standing there, and she looks at me, and she goes, no, my computer says the planes are flying. I said, really? Well, CNN, there was CNN right there on the TV screen, and everything from Washington, D.C. north is in a virtual whiteout. I live in Maine. It's like next to Canada. I do not want to be stranded in Detroit. Worst place in the world to be stranded, Detroit. Well, we can change a plane. It cost you $1,400. Never mind, I'll get on the plane. So I get on the plane. I get to Detroit. Sure enough, there's nothing flying out of Detroit or any other place. And there are no hotel rooms left now because it's now 8:30 at night, and everybody's already got all the hotel rooms that were available. So I'm going through the tunnel, and I see this little old lady. And the third time I saw her, I thought, well, I guess I should be helping her. You know, and I started thinking, you know, if that was my mom, I'd want somebody to help her. And so anyway, I go over and I say to her, excuse me, ma'am, are you traveling alone? And she says, yes. And I said, well, why don't you come with me and I'll look out for you in the night and make sure that you're all okay and all that. She said, okay. So I go and I find the softest chair I could find in the airport that wasn't already taken. And I sit her in it and I go, how's that? And she says, not good. I said, well, what's the matter? And she goes, well, I'm cold and I need a blanket. So I go traipsing all over the airport looking for a blanket, right? I finally see somebody that came off a plane. I said, excuse me, can you get me a blanket and a pillow? I'm traveling with an elderly woman and she's cold. Sure. So I get the blanket and the pillow. I bring it back. I get her all tucked in. I said, you all set now? She's no. I said, what's the matter? She said, you'd think, for God's sakes, if they were going to strand us in this friggin' airport all night long, the least they could do is leave the bar open so we could get good and drunk. I said, of course, I picked up the drunk old lady, you know. But while I was sitting there watching her that night, this came to me, and I wrote it down, and it's my adaption of the Footsteps Prayer, and it goes like this. One night a man had a dream. He was looking down at the beach and he saw a set of footprints drunkenly zigzagging in circles. Then he saw two sets of footprints, one large, one small, one his, one God's. Next, the small footprints stepped into the large footprints and began to grow. Then once again, the footprints were zigzagging around with wild abandon. This really bothered the man. And he said to God, when I asked for help, you came and walked with me. And God said, yes, I gave you the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as you began to put them into practice, you began to grow. The man said, then God, I don't understand. If I was doing the footwork, what happened? And God, why the wild zigzagging again? And God said, oh, my precious one, I would not abandon you. After you learned the steps, we danced. I hope you stick around for the dance. Thanks for asking me to share.